Thanks for tuning to Digital Voices Podcast, where we chat digital transformation, challenges and opportunities across healthcare and life sciences. And now, your host, Ed Marks.
Ed here with Digital Voices. Another exciting episode. It really is the greatest job, I think, in healthcare is to host Digital Voices because I get to meet such amazing people. And Lisbeth Wotruba and I have met previously, but in terms of, you know, being able to spend time together with great leaders and learning more about them, there's nothing like it. And Digital Voices, we really thank you for listening. We know you have a lot of choices out there in terms of what you can listen to. And we're top 5% now in the globe. And one reason is just consistency, but the biggest reason is guests like Lisbeth who make the show. And finally, we have no commercials or sponsors. It's just pure content. So that's what's cool. So Lisbeth, welcome to Digital Voices.
Thanks, Dad.
So you're the Chief Clinical Officer of Avasure. We're going to talk more about that a little bit later in the whole virtual nursing, which has taken the industry by storm, like one of the true digital transformations that's occurring. And I don't want to jump too far ahead. So let me stick with my script here for a second. We first met, I was invited to speak at an event. Avasure had a sales event in Dallas-Fort Worth. I know Adam, the CEO, he's been very helpful to me in getting my Marks Advisory up and running. So I'm really thankful to him. And he asked me to come speak to the team and I spoke and you were there. And so we connected because, you know, on the whole clinical side, some of the stories I told, and I was like, wow, I want to have you as my first guest ever on Behind the Mask. And you were. So for listeners who, after listening to this, want to hear more, you can find that on my YouTube channel. And that's a little bit more personal. So while this podcast is on the professional side, the Behind the Mask is a little bit more about the person themselves. So long introduction here, but we're getting right into it. So songs on your playlist, Lisbeth, everyone wants to know, what do you listen to?
Okay, first of all, thanks for having me back. And I was that Behind the Mask episode being the inaugural guest is quite the honor. And it turned out to be much more personal than I thought. And Behind the Mask is like a Phantom of the Opera mask, but I also thought about like Behind the Surgical Mask.
Yes.
I don't know if you thought about that, but anyways, thank you for that. And great to be talking with you again. And you'll be surprised. What's on my playlist now I'm really into is the Oppenheimer soundtrack by Ludwig Göransson is the composer, but it just really like puts physics into music. And one of the songs is called Can You Hear the Music, which is a quote from the movie. So I would recommend watching the visuals with that as well, but it's epic.
I'm going to have to look that up. I had no idea. Yeah. I haven't seen the movie yet, and it's on my list. So I'm going to definitely look that up. And I know you like The Police because our audience can't see it, but we can see each other just for the enhancing our ability to communicate during a podcast recording. And I'm wearing a Police concert t-shirt. So we're talking about The Police and about Sting. And so I know that's one of your bands as well.
Yeah, that was my junior high crush, Sting.
Yeah, Sting, he was one handsome guy. There's no doubt about it. But see, when I got to see them in concert, they had the Go-Go's opening up. So I got, my fix. You know, I was in love with Belinda Carlisle and probably some of the others in that band. So tell me about your life message or mantra. Is there sort of words that you live by?
You know, that question, actually, I have behind me here on my desk this poem, Desiderata, by Max Ehrman. And it's hard to say like one thing, but this poem has a lot of that in it that reminds me to stay balanced. And it's optimistic, but realistic and kind of beautiful. And so it starts with go placidly amidst the noise and haste. And there's another phrase in here. No doubt the universe is unfolding as it should. And so I like to think, you know, when I get anxious, I it's a good touchstone for me.
Yeah. And tell me the name of the poem one more time.
It's called Desiderata, D-E-S-I-D-E-R-A-T-A. it's probably 30, 40 years old.
Yeah, I'm going to look that up. No, it sounds.
Yeah.
That's why we ask these questions. Not only do we get a little bit of glimpse inside of our guests, but, you know, everyone gets to learn something new. I've learned so much new music as a result of this and a lot of really great words to live by. In fact, someday, my producer and I, we've always talked about having a playlist, a song list of all the music. And so the Digital Voices playlist on Spotify, and then something with all the quotes as well. So, Elizabeth, let's jump right into the next section, which is a little bit more about you and what you do at Avershire. But tell us your story. And I know a little bit, right? You come from a line of nurses. I mean, go back as far as you want, but I'm really interested to learn more about you.
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, I was a minister's daughter growing up in the Midwest. And my mother, my grandmothers, several aunts are nurses. And I just got kind of drawn into that field. And but then I ended up moving to San Francisco when I was 19 with my parents, which really broadened my horizons. And they were supportive. Especially my mother really encouraged me to pursue education, but I did have to pay for that myself. So I, you know, took the bus, took the BART, and worked as a sitter at UCSF. So there's a little foreshadowing there.
Yeah.
I worked as a one-to-one sitter and nursing assistant at UCSF while I was in nursing school. And then when I graduated in, to look at my degree up here, I think it was probably early 90s, there was a glut of nurses, and I had a hard time getting a job in California. So I ended up moving and living with some relatives in New York, and then worked in ICU, loved the tech, like loved being a control freak, and just like really focused on a couple of patients in the ICU, and then went to graduate school at Columbia to study as a nurse practitioner. That was wonderful experience, just seeing a heart transplant, you know, from seeing the donor to the, you know, the empty chest cavity and coming to life. And, you know, so the Columbia grad school was wonderful as an acute care nurse practitioner. Then got married and was pregnant with my first child. My husband at the time had just finished his fellowship. So we ended up back in the Midwest, and I've been here in Grand Rapids, Michigan since then. And one of the things I love about the profession of nursing is just all the opportunities, many different paths. And so I try to have a plan, and that plan and goals helps me, but then something might distract me, and then opportunity comes and I take different turns, which I think we'll talk about a little bit.
Yeah. So yeah, it's super interesting. So tell us how you got into, you were doing nursing. And that is funny. I didn't realize that you had been a sitter, physical sitter. But eventually you make your way with Avershire. So tell us how that happened, how long you've been with Avershire and the whole context of that.
Right. So back in the early 2000s, I was working as a clinical nurse specialist and magnet program director at a Catholic hospital here in town, which I love. Was a wonderful 13 years of growth, professional growth and experience. And during that time, we opened a new tower, and it was 2008, and we wanted to be futuristic. So we put cameras in every room, potentially acuity adaptable is what we were thinking. So two floors, 64 beds. And not only was it was pan tilt zoom, 360 degrees, night vision, speaker, microphone. So we had a pretty well set up, and it was a security company called ROK at the time that won the bid on that. And then we actually opened in 2009, and the economic situation had drastically changed, and we certainly weren't going to lead into opening up a big virtual ICU or something at the time. So I was in charge of rapid response and telemetry, cardiac monitoring, and some of those other areas. And so it was kind of like, Elizabeth, why don't you take this and run with it? And what we found out was that the poor telemetry techs were just keeping an eye video-wise on a few confused patients, and they were able to redirect them verbally before they fell. You know, they would see they were starting to stand up or something. It was challenging though, because they were trying to also monitor a bunch of telemetry patients. So I tried to make the case that we needed to staff that, and maybe it could be a sitter replacement idea, and kind of chased the CFO down the hall one day, because I had been denied. The productivity team said, no, there's no evidence that that works. So, and I said, you know, we could watch multiple patients virtually instead of one-on-ones and for the sitters. And that made sense to him. And so he suggested I work through the foundation. And so I got some funding through the foundation to study that. The rest of the funding came from the CEO and founder of the surveillance company, which then has become Avasure. And so we were hospital number one. It worked very well. A lot of other hospitals were coming to see, like, what is this sitter, you know, solution? We have this pain point with sitters. And so now it's really a mainstream virtual sitting where one monitor, unlicensed personnel, can keep 12 to 16 patients safe. And we're in 1,100 hospitals across the country and in Canada, and now leaning into virtual nursing.
Yeah. And so you must be are you one of the first employees of Avasure?
No, for a while I stayed at the hospital and completed the research and was kind of their best reference, or maybe their only reference for a while. And so I came on board, I think we had maybe 25 employees, and now we're 10 times that. Yeah.
Wow.
That was 9 years ago that I joined Avasure.
Yeah. And what's one thing that's changed in those 9 years in terms of, I don't know, it could be product, services, number of people that you just mentioned, you know, what's one thing that's changed that's notable?
Yeah, I don't want to spoil your thunder, but one of the other questions is it tactical or is it transformational? Yeah. And I think we really started out tactical. It was very specific. We decreased falls and decreased one-to-one sitter expenses, but that's kind of tactical and narrow. It's a huge problem, and it was the only thing that actually works for that, and that's evidence-based. But since then, it has really evolved to a virtual care platform really focused on acute care. And the platform is opened up so that we can, you know, we're integrating with artificial intelligence, and of course we integrate with electronic health records. And so I think what's probably changed is the opening up of the architecture and becoming more transformational rather than just solving this specific pain point.
Yeah. I think it's amazing. You know, I sit on the board of a couple health systems, and, you know, nursing shortages and cost of nursing, traveler nurses, those sort of things is always front and center. And virtual nursing is really like one of the solutions. And it is beneficial for a wide variety of reasons, not just cost, but I think with burnout and things like that. Now I don't want to take your thunder in terms of anything else that we may talk about, but why do you think you are in 1,100 facilities, and I imagine there's competitors that are in some more. Why do you think it's become so mainstream? Or maybe we already answered that question.
Well, no, I think that has been, I don't know, it's tired to say tipping point, but there has been a real kind of change in impetus in the last few years with shortages and then squeeze on margins. And then no longer is the government funding coming in to help with COVID, and nurses have, they felt like they couldn't abandon their teammates in the middle of the war. But now that, you know, COVID is a little more of an endemic, they're retiring and burned out. And so we know that there's a shortage in nurses. And so I think that is forcing it. And we talk a lot about the shortage of nurses and nurses working at the top of their license. The vacancy rate is close to 20% across the board right now for nurses in acute care. But what isn't talked about as much is the unlicensed personnel, nursing assistants. That turnover is north of 30% in acute care, and it's more competitive. So now you're competing with McDonald's for that staff, and nurses can't delegate and keep at the top of their license if there's no one for them to delegate to. So it's an opportunity. It's a moment to re-examine our traditional practice and really scrutinize what is necessary, what is waste, and how can we bring healthcare up to where it really should be anyways, digitally.
Yeah, I don't know if you can identify a hospital, and you don't need to if you can't.
Oh,
you can if
yeah.
you want. But one hospital example of sort of that virtual nursing impact.
We've done a webinar recently, and we'll be at Becker's IT with UC Health. So that is in Denver, Colorado. And they're one example that has done this whole adoption model. So, and they were thinking about this pre-pandemic, but they started with centralizing telemetry, and they call them safety observers, which is the virtual sitters, across their 12 to 13 hospitals. And then they recognized that they needed support of some new community hospitals from the ICU at night. And so they built and built and built. And now they have a digital hospital. It's a hospital. It has a CNO and it has an ACMO of this not brick and mortar hospital. And so they started with that really kind of tactical, tangible ROI outcomes with safety observers and centralizing telemetry. And they built in nighttime intensivists. And then on top of that, now they do virtual deterioration and virtual ICU nursing 24/7 across all. And the virtual deterioration is a really interesting type of virtual nursing. And that is when there's a rapid response call on any of those 13 hospitals. The rapid response nurse is there for the first 20, 30 minutes. But our mobile two-way device and the virtual nurse is in the room for 6 hours. And making sure that that patient is on the right trajectory, that they're, you know, hitting their sepsis bundle, that sepsis is a common reason. And they've really seen lives saved with that. And so that's an example of an adoption model. You know, start where you can kind of start tactical and have that fund as you grow across yeah. to the point where I can imagine a world easily where every room has a virtual solution in it. And there's all kinds of things that's going, that's just making it seamless and easy with artificial intelligence and natural language processing, and patients are safer and mature nurses get to keep practicing. And so I'm excited about it. I'm ready to embrace it.
Yeah, no, it is super exciting. You know, I'm married to a nurse, as you know, and it's cool to see this sort of technology be able to truly transform nursing and patient care. And yeah, I should have thought of the UC Health example myself, because I wrote a book on Voices of Innovation, and one of them was actually UC Health. And then I had the good fortune, I was keynote speaker someplace in Denver recently, and one of the other speakers was a member of that team that I cannot remember her name, but you would know.
Patel or Hemali Patel, yeah.
Those sound familiar, and they were telling the story, and it was just amazing. And I think, I mean, where do you think we're sort of ultimately headed? You know, like, you know, we talk a lot about hospital at home, and this is the same sort of technology, right, that would enable hospital at home.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. And it is just kind of about bringing the solution, and that improves access for patients. And I also just did a presentation with Holzer Health, which is kind of the other end of the spectrum. Holzer Health is really small. It's in southeastern Ohio. And they also, and so it's like one little less than 300 bed hospital and a critical access hospital, which is like 30 minutes away. And so they are doing virtual sitting, keeping patients safe in both facilities. And then they have a wound ostomy nurse that's able to see patients quickly, and a neurologist able to see patients quickly in the critical access. And then that's great for them, because then the patient is closer to their home and they get discharged earlier in the day, and they get the benefit of, you know, specialty nurses and specialty physicians. So
yeah,
I mean, that's common sense. That's where we're headed.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So one last piece before we move on, just talk about leadership. But any advice that you would give to a nurse who maybe grew up, was trained in an era before virtual nursing and these sort of capabilities, and want, realizes they want and need to sort of make that transition. So, you know, any sort of advice you'd give someone like to help them in that transition?
An excellent question, because we all are just have this mission of, you know, patients first. And so it's really hard to look at your own practice that you've been practicing for 30 years and trust that someone else could do part of that. And which part can I let go of? And the data is showing us that it's the admissions. So we collect data from multi-sites about what kind of virtual visits are happening with virtual nursing. And it's 5-1 admissions versus discharges. If I was the CNO, I would say, let's start with the discharges, because yeah, that, you know, we need to kind of clear out some beds and make room for new patients to come in. But the bedside nurses are more willing to embrace the admission first, and then kind of like, we remember that, you and I probably remember that Wheaties commercial, try it, you'll like it. You know, so yeah, that's the way to, you know, get started with, a process that, so the admission process has a lot of kind of structure to it, and maybe even some busy work that they feel more comfortable to delegate. So I think it's just make that first step, and then it gains its own momentum.
Yeah, that's good advice. What's the most enjoyable aspect of being chief clinical officer of a virtual health company?
My role, and I feel like I'm in a time warp, like I'm almost kind of back where I was 9 years ago when virtual sitting was an unknown, innovative concept. And now we're there with virtual nursing. And I just love to get nurses to research and publish and talk about their findings and take the time to do that. Back when we were first starting, it was kind of like, trust me, it works. You know, and now we have like, I guess, probably 150 case studies. So if we're not on video, but like I'm holding up a heavy binder of all the presentations and articles that nurses have done. And this is in the scope of nursing practice. And so I have DNP students, and often someone's reaching out and like, how do I display my data better? And I can just kind of help them with the lit review because I know it and I have time, you know, so I really enjoy that networking with colleagues.
Yeah. And I'm so glad that you all take the time to do the measures, because, you know, when I was working with, I don't take much time to tell a story, but when I was working with different health systems, I was always trying to get them to measure, like, let's measure, because then you can find the results and then you can make improvements, all that kind of stuff. And very few, you know, they're always so much in a hurry and stuff that they wouldn't measure. And I was like, it's a lost opportunity. So I'm glad to see you all do it. And I'm glad you're working with DNP students, because my wife is a DNP student. Hard to get research done. She did it all and got her degree. But if someone was doing something in virtual care, I mean, you'd be an excellent resource. All right. So what's the best advice you ever received?
So your questions are so superlative. Like, you know, what is your mantra for life? And what is the best? It's such an intimidating question, because what if I don't pick the best? Anyways, I'll pick one that came to mind when I read that. Yeah. And it came from my executive coach. So I have an executive coach, which has been very helpful, kind of an outside person on Team Lizbeth, who has really helped me these last several years, especially. And one of her frequently repeated advice is, it's okay not to be comfortable, or it's okay to be uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And whether that is, I'm sitting in a board meeting and I'm not slouched, I'm sitting up and maybe I'm thirsty, but I'm just going to wait, you know, or if it is something much larger, like leaning into something you're afraid to do. But I think being comfortable with being uncomfortable is kind of just a really good mantra to think about in general, if you want to stretch.
I think that's great. It's a good piece of advice. I think that we can all definitely use. What about the hardest decision you've ever had to make?
So you have a way of making people feel comfortable to kind of open up. And I was pretty honest on the behind the mask, and I got so much great feedback that I'm going to tell a personal story here. And it is like hands down the hardest decision I had to make. And if it helps anybody else, I hope that it would be worth it. But and I talked to my daughter, and she is comfortable with me sharing this. But when she was a teen, she was running away from home and using drugs. And the school counselor said she needs help. And so and she needs to be removed from this setting and her peers, and just kind of like a reset, and like a 28-day rehab is not going to cut it, and do something now before she's an adult. And so I talked to other people that had been through this, and we really decided that, you know, we would send her to wilderness therapy in, and we did that in Colorado. And then from there, 3 months out in the wilderness, no showers, no, you know, not seeing the inside, building fires for herself, just finding herself and like resetting her brain wiring and gaining some confidence. And then she did her junior year in high school in a residential treatment center. But making that decision to have some security people come to our house at 4 a.m. and take her away on a plane was the most difficult decision. And I remember her father, my husband at the time, said, if she had cancer, would we try to treat her here at home? Or do we need experts to help us? Which, because I felt like I was abdicating my parenting, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But that was helpful to hear. And we've had just such a wonderful outcome. And she's about to graduate from college now. And and she's grateful for that experience. And she wrote her college essay, because she had to make up for some bad grades on that, about her experience there in the wilderness. So,
that would be heart-wrenching as a parent myself. But yeah, it sounds like the best decision, hardest decision, and best decision. And see, Elizabeth, you're not supposed to make, you did this last time, you're not supposed to make the host cry. And you're like making me cry here. So I got to be careful with my questions. I'm going to be a softball. I know. We're not going to do any more shows together. But I'll give you sort of a easy one here as we sort of wind down, but important. How do you recharge your batteries and remain fresh? So, you know, obviously being a chief clinical officer, as much as you love the work and Abishur, you know, certainly is challenging. It's a lot of leadership that you provide. And you know, you're just doing a lot of different things. So how do you sort of wind down?
I live on a lake, and so I do love paddleboarding. In the summers, Michigan is cold in the winter. So I do like cross country skiing in the winter. And I was like looking at the sky and then I try to think about my five senses. You know, what am I seeing? What colors am I seeing? What light and shadow am I seeing? What birds am I hearing? Where are they? You know, there are always cars. You know, what am I feeling? The wind, and, you know, just trying to get back into, I guess, mindfulness while I'm outside. And so I do that intentionally. And that's something I learned from when my daughter was in wilderness. That's what they taught her, and that's what they taught us as a family. And it's funny, I didn't mean to relate that back, but that's one of the things that I do intentionally to kind of reset.
Yeah, I like that. And that's an easy concept to remember. Wow, we spoke about so many different things, from some great new music to, you know, the things that you do as part of Abishur, how you got into nursing, just your whole background. We talk a lot about digital in healthcare and leadership. Is there something we missed or something you want to double down on? I give you the last word.
Maybe I'll just end with a story. It's very fresh in my mind. I was at a nursing conference just last week, And I sat down at lunch next to a pretty young looking nurse and someone who's kind of in between. And we were talking about our nursing practice. And I found out that this younger nurse, I'll call her Rose, has been a nurse for 6 months. And she works in a med-surg setting. And she was getting pretty discouraged. And she shared with us that she recently had a patient fall in the bathroom. That was the patient's second fall on the admission. And so it was known that she was at risk. And then she had her second fall and broke her hip in the bathroom. And she was kind of relating the whole root cause analysis that they went through afterwards. And one of the heartrending things she said was that her patient apologized to her. And her patient said, "Rose, I'm so sorry. I know you told me to, you know, pull on this cord when I was done, but I could see how busy you are and I didn't want to bother you." And Rose had nursing assistants pulled off the floor that day. She had a pretty high ratio of patients. And she said to the leadership on the root cause analysis, "You are not committed to your mission." And she told them the mission. And I kind of challenged her gently. And I said, "You work there. That's not their mission. That's your mission too.
Yeah.
Why didn't you word it, 'We're not committed to our mission'?" And she started crying. And she talked about that she has kind of a personal mission in nursing about taking care of patients. But she just doesn't feel like she can achieve that right now. So this just like lit a fire.
Yeah.
Not that I already didn't have one, but like, you know, and I know virtual care is not the panacea, but the digital transformation or transformation is. And let's all play a part to help Rose and her patient and the other nurse that was there. We both like encouraged her and we're like, "Please don't leave the profession. You're awesome."
Yeah, right.
And so I think she's gonna be amazing and make change. If she was that assertive 6 months out, she'll be okay. And those are the kind of nurses that are gonna help us.
Yeah, that's a great story. Summarizes a lot of the content that we spoke about. Elizabeth, thank you so much for being our guest and for being so vulnerable and authentic with us, and a very, very meaningful conversation. Thank you for all that you do. And I'm glad you're out there, you know, leading the way.
Thank you, Ed.
All right. That wraps up Digital Voices. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening to Digital Voices Podcast with Ed Martin. If you enjoyed this episode, subscribe on your preferred streaming service and leave a rating and review. And most importantly, thanks again for listening.